please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new data analysis by researchers at Georgetown University pinpoints a number of under-vaccinated clusters of the United States that pose a significant threat to the nation's and potentially the world's gradual progress against the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly given their potential to serve as factories for extremely contagious variants such as the now dominant Delta strain. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, "As Delta Runs Rampant, Analysis Pinpoints 5 Under-Vaccinated Clusters, Putting Entire U.S. at Risk." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A new data analysis by researchers at Georgetown University pinpoints a number of under-vaccinated clusters of the United States of America that pose a significant threat to the nation's and potentially the world's gradual progress against the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly given their potential to serve as factories for extremely contagious variants such as the now dominant Delta strain. The five most significant clusters identified by the Georgetown researchers are largely located in southern U.S., in states such as Georgia, Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, all of which are currently experiencing a rise in coronavirus cases as Delta rips through communities concentrated with people who have yet to receive a single vaccine shot. Those clusters include more than 15 million people. The group of counties in each cluster together have lower vaccination coverage than expected and make up a large population size. All of the top five clusters are focused in southeastern U.S., their researchers noted. The more geographically clustered unvaccinated individuals are, the analysis continues, the higher the chance that an unvaccinated individual will interact with another unvaccinated individual, and the higher the chance that a disease transmission event will occur. Low vaccination clusters, therefore, are locations where risk of transmission of COVID-19 remains high in the absence of social distancing and masking. Because variant emergence stems from disease transmission, The report notes that every new transmission of the disease creates an opportunity for a new variant to transmit to another host and take hold in a population. Therefore, the researchers write, curbing transmission events is best recourse to prevent variant emergence. Dr. Jonathan Rayner, a CNN medical analyst and professor of medicine and surgery at Georgetown University, said these clusters of unvaccinated people are what is standing in the way of us putting this virus down permanently. Rayner added, "We have been lucky with the variant so far that we have been relatively susceptible to our vaccine, but the more you roll the dice, the more opportunities there will be for a resistant variant." The Georgetown analysis came as President Biden said, "Right now, as I speak to you, millions of Americans are still unvaccinated and unprotected. And because of that, their communities are at risk. Their friends are at risk. The people they care about are at risk. This is an even bigger concern because of the Delta variant." According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Delta strain, which is estimated to be 60% more transmissible than the previously dominant Alpha mutation, accounted for more than half of all new coronavirus infections in the U.S. between June 20th and July 3rd, as it sweeps across the U.S. and the globe. But Politico reported recently that Biden administration officials believe the Delta mutation is significantly more widespread in the U.S. than the current federal projections. One unnamed official told Politico, "It is everywhere now. The risk really is in the unvaccinated community. We are starting to see more and more people get sick and need medical attention."
Lebanon is just days away from a social explosion. The stark warning has been made by Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who has called on the international community to help the country avoid an all-out economic and social crisis. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is now experiencing one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Diab has been serving in a caretaker capacity since resigning in the wake of the catastrophic August 4 Beirut port explosion. More than 200 people were killed and over 6,000 others injured in the giant blast. Dozens of people are still unaccounted for. Since then, politicians have been unable to agree on a new government. I appeal through you to the kings, princes, presidents, and leaders of brotherly and friendly countries. And I call upon the United Nations and all international bodies, the international community, and the global public opinion to help save the Lebanese from death and prevent the demise of Lebanon. Diab has urged friendly nations to help Lebanon despite the lack of a new government. He said only a new cabinet could restart talks with the International Monetary Fund so that the country may get out of its deepening crisis.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come. Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened, with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country, and this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
Iran has been a major victim of terrorism over the past decades, with over 17,000 Iranians losing their lives in terrorist attacks. Iran has long criticized Western states, especially the United States, for employing double standards in dealing with terrorism. The West's support for anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen-e Khalq organization, also known as the MKO, is a case in point. The notorious Mujahideen-e Khalq organization is responsible for the killing of about 12,000 Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. The group has carried out bombings and assassinations across Iran. The MKO is a well-known enemy of the Iranian nation with a horrific record that is known to all countries in the region and beyond. During the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, the MKO joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to carry out cross-border attacks. They also helped the former Iraqi dictator to crack down on dissent at home. After the war, MKO members spent many years in a camp in Iraq's Diyala province before being relocated to Albania in 2016. The cult-like group does not tolerate any form of dissent within the organization. Former MKO members who managed to leave the group have painted a grim picture of how the organization treats its members, especially those who intend to leave the MKO. They have reported abuses ranging from solitary confinements to severe beatings and torture. Over the past years, MKO summits have been attended by hawkish U.S. politicians such as former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The U.S. politicians are said to have received hefty sums to attend MKO summits and back the group's calls for regime change in Iran. Observers believe the American and European stances regarding the MKO have exposed their double standards in dealing with terrorism.
When they say that they want to fight terrorist organizations, what they mean is they want to fight every sort of organization that is in any way an obstacle in the further benefit of Western hegemony. We have seen the term terrorism being used over and over and over again to assign any and every sort of organization, even the ones that are not even violent, any sort of organization that opposes imperialism.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization was on the U.S. list of terrorist groups for 15 years, but then removed in 2012 to pave the way for the MKO to receive funds more easily. Iran says lobbies in the United States were heavily bribed that year to facilitate the controversial removal. Major European countries, including France, also removed it from their blacklist. Top MKO members, including its public face, Maryam Rajavi, have been moving closer to hawkish U.S. politicians. The deepening ties between U.S. and European governments and Mujahideen Khalq terror group suggests that the West may be trying to use the MKO to pressure Iran.
It is not surprising, unfortunately, to see such a close collusion between the MKO and the United States of America. We have seen this happen for the past 30, 40 years. And this has become very clear a couple of years ago, of course, when they held a massive rally in which they invited people such as John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani, some of the most imperialist war hawks that the United States has ever known in the past, let's say, century. So when they attend meetings of the MKO and when they speak there of what they consider the need for, quote-unquote, spreading democracy to Iran, this is what they are trying to achieve. The resurgence of U.S. imperialist control.
How can Western states be supporting this notorious terrorist group and at the same time accuse other countries of backing terrorism?
In what may appear to be an effort to gain more popularity, the anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen Khalq, or MKO, has signed a deal with a Washington-based lobby group. The terror group had clinched a $40,000 agreement with the BGR lobbying group. BGR includes former senior-level Democrats and Republicans in the White House, Congress, and U.S. executive branch departments and agencies. U.S. media, citing documents filed with the Justice Department, say the American lobby firm will now help out with the annual conference, which has previously seen top U.S. officials attend the gathering. But getting a new lobbying group ahead of the conference raises questions if things are not going too well with the terror group. It also raises further questions about Washington's agenda and role behind their support for the MKO. Under the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump, the MKO enjoyed warm support from the White House, who imposed the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. With the Biden administration coming in, things have slightly changed. Biden has been sending a delegation to Vienna, which is engaged indirectly in talks with Iran with a view to revive the Iran nuclear deal. There is a new president-elect in Iran as well, so the MKO may need to go back to the drawing board on how to approach their conference this year. The U.S. State Department added the MKO to its list of foreign terrorist organizations in 1997 for the group's involvement in the killing of Americans in Iran in the 1970s and an attack on U.S. soil in 1992. The group has also been described as a bizarre, shadowy, brainwashing cult. According to a 2007 State Department report, MKO members are also required to take a vow of eternal divorce and participate in weekly ideological cleansing sessions. Washington designated it as a terror outfit for 15 years, until a wide-scale campaign by U.S. officials and lobbying groups backed by millions of dollars resulted in a successful delisting in 2012.
Former attendees at the MKO events have admitted to receiving tens of thousands of dollars from the terrorists in speaking engagement fees. Most notably, at their now annual lavish conference in the French capital, Paris. One participant at this conference and longtime supporter of the group is former US National Security Advisor and top Iran hawk, John Bolton, who regularly speaks at MKO events. He once infamously declared that before 2019, they will be celebrating with him in the Iranian capital, Tehran itself, something that did not exactly materialize as planned, as noted by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Other prominent supporters are ex-US President Donald Trump's personal lawyer and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, another long-term supporter who acknowledged being on the MKO's payroll, former US House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and former Saudi Arabian spy chief Prince Turki Al-Faisal. The terror group was located in Iraq under the Saddam Hussein era and committed numerous atrocities against Iranians using Iraqi soil until Saddam himself was toppled. That's when America helped them set up a base in Albania and the freedom to travel between Europe and America, where they are said to have aggressively tried to purchase the services of former and current Western government employees. However, members in the highly fortified camp in Albania are prevented from leaving, meaning some parents have not seen their children in decades. Big double standards here by the United States. Terrorists they don't like are met with bombs. Terrorists they do like, who have even killed American civilians, are supported and met with hospitality. Tehran has warned Washington against being misled by the group's anti-Iran propaganda campaign, saying Washington has suffered every time it's trusted the MKO. Yet, since 2012, Western officials and allied media outlets have tried their best to propagandize the terrorists as an Iranian opposition group.
On June 24th, a 12-story building collapsed in Surfside, Florida, trapping dozens under the rubble. Search operations for the bodies of the victims have been underway since. Investigations are underway to establish the cause of the tragic incident. The building was built in 1981 and was undergoing a recertification process requiring repairs. A 2018 report by a consultant engineer had warned about major structural damage to the building. The incident, one of the US worst in years, attracted the media's attention and has been making headlines for days. But there are other similarly or even more tragic accidents occurring around the country that aren't paid much attention to in the press. These include an average of 316 shootings that take place in the US, resulting in 106 deaths every day, or the reports on an average of 20 veterans are dying by suicide on a daily basis.
There's an issue here in terms of news coverage about how do you deal with chronic issues of homelessness, of excess death, of death from the heat. I mean, in the Northwest, there have been several hundred people who have died as a result of the heat, the high temperatures up in Washington and Oregon and British Columbia. That's a huge story as well. More people died there than in Florida. And yet the Florida thing has sort of been the magnet for the media. And they really like, as there's a saying in the American press, if it bleeds, it leads. And Florida fits into that.
During the Independence Day weekend alone, at least 150 people were killed in more than 400 shootings across the country. U.S. President Joe Biden announced late last month that the Senate had struck a bipartisan agreement for a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill to provide funding for the country's roads, bridges, the power grid, public transport, and internet. He, however, said the plan can't succeed unless a separate $6 trillion budget bill is passed. U.S. Republicans are openly opposed to the suggestion, arguing that the bill will create such a debt that can prove quite taxing on the U.S. economy. What there's a bipartisan consensus about is America's military spending, standing at roughly $700 billion. Between 2015 and 2020, U.S. military spending increased by 15%. The U.S. military budget is three times more than China and a whole order of magnitude larger than that of its arch-rival, Russia. The military budget President Biden has called for represents a 0.4% cut compared to last year's spending. This has sparked criticism from Democrats and Republicans alike. That comes against the backdrop of the U.S. infrastructure that's outlived its usefulness.
Equal part of the industrial economy in the United States are military contracts. And so there is this sort of huge, sort of built-in bias to the military and the way in which it's discussed. Finally, the budget system here, which is obscure, I think, to almost everybody, including most people in this country, is divided into two parts. And the part that's called discretionary is the one where all of the stuff like the internet or infrastructure or highways, that's discretionary. Defense is treated separately and is treated as something that cannot be reduced within the budgetary framework.
Which one should be the priority, securing interests abroad or ensuring the immediate safety and security of the people inside the borders?
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The official global death toll from COVID-19 hit 4 million on Wednesday, July 7th, a tragic milestone, said the World Health Organization chief as he blasted vaccine nationalism as a morally indefensible position. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "It Didn't Have to Be This Way." WHO chief laments 4 million COVID-19 deaths. Here's more on the story. The official global death toll from COVID-19 hit 4 million on Wednesday, July 7th, a tragic milestone, said the World Health Organization chief, as he blasted vaccine nationalism as a morally indefensible position. That number of fatalities is likely an underestimate, World Health Organization WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom said in his remarks at a press briefing. Also troubling, he said, are fast-moving variants of the coronavirus and premature dropping by some authorities of public health measures meant to contain the spread of the pandemic. Vaccine nationalism, where a handful of nations have taken the lion's share, is morally indefensible, said Tedros, as well as an ineffective public health strategy against a respiratory virus that is mutating quickly and becoming increasingly effective at moving from human to human. Variants are currently winning the race against vaccines because of inequitable vaccine production and distribution, which also threatens the global economic recovery, Tedros said. It didn't have to be this way, he added, and it doesn't have to be this way going forward. We'll be right back. Over 3.2 billion doses have been administered worldwide, but their distribution has been starkly unequal. Just 1% of people in low-income countries have received at least one dose, according to tracking by World in Data. Tedros has repeatedly criticized unequal access to COVID-19 vaccines, declaring in May, for example, the ongoing vaccine crisis is a scandalous inequity that is perpetuating the pandemic. Backing up that assessment is the emergence of coronavirus variants, including the highly contagious Delta variant, which is being blamed for a surge in COVID-19 cases in Bangladesh and elsewhere. Sanjeev Kafli, head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's Bangladesh delegation, said recently that mass vaccination is the key to ending the spiraling deaths, infections, and hardships caused by this virus in Bangladesh and everywhere around the world. Unequal access to doses is an obstacle to such mass vaccination and equity that's been the focus of the People's Vaccine Alliance, a coalition of over 50 organizations like Global Justice Now, Amnesty International, and Oxfam. The groups accuse rich nations such as the U.S. of hoarding COVID-19 vaccines, while a small number of pharmaceutical companies control production and distribution of doses, and thereby get to decide who lives and who dies, despite the fact that they created many of these vaccines with public money. Everyone deserves protection from COVID-19, not just the richest, the coalition said recently. Like WHO's Tedros, the alliance said the world needn't have arrived at the 4 million death toll figure and won't further. Needless death will come to pass, barring a huge boost in vaccine production. Lamenting the horrific milestone, Anna Marriott, Oxfam's health policy manager and spokesperson for the People's Vaccine Alliance, said on July 7th, many of these deaths could have been prevented had the successful vaccine science been shared and production of doses ramped up by more manufacturers across the world. Pharmaceutical corporations are making eye-watering profits, she said, but are refusing to share the vaccine science and know-how. Marriott singled out the UK and Germany, which are now grabbing up supplies of booster shots for their citizens before many nations have secured even first doses, and demanded they back a proposal at the World Trade Organization to temporarily waive intellectual property protections on COVID-19-related technology. A suspension of trade rules, Marriott said, would allow developing countries to make their own vaccines so that everyone, no matter where they live, can share the hope of a future free from COVID. Communique.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the man at the head of the Israeli occupation for 12 years, has finally been outplayed. His numerous attempts to stay in power, outmaneuver his opponents, and keep his political rivals at bay granted him a reign lasting from 2009 until 2021, but that has come to a swift end. He's been replaced by Naftali Bennett, a man who proudly claims to be even more right-wing than his predecessor, and has openly bragged about killing Arabs. So the question now is, What difference does this make for Palestinians? What difference does it make for the region and for those living under Israeli occupation for the better part of almost 80 years? What of their fate? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Now, before proceeding with the program, it's important to note that Israel is not a legitimate state. It is a racist entity that has been illegally occupying Palestine since 1948 and Syria's Golan Heights since 1967. So when we speak of a so-called Israeli government, we are talking about the administration or the regime that is running the occupation and nothing more. Israel is not recognized as a country by a majority of Arab and Muslim countries and is no more a country than the British occupation in India or the German occupation of Poland or France. Their so-called elections, ministers, and officials have no legitimacy and will only be referred to as such in the program for the sake of simplicity and brevity, nothing more. Now, on June 13, 2021, Benjamin Netanyahu lost his title as the Prime Minister of Israel. In the timeline of events preceding his downfall, many things occurred that led to his ouster. During the last 2 years, from 2019 to 2021, the Israelis had held four elections, all of them inconclusive, as no party was actually able to win a majority out of 120 seats. On April 6, 2021, Netanyahu was given 28 days to form a coalition government, but was unable to do so. And consequently, a few weeks after, on May 5th, the president of the Israeli occupation, Rivlin, turned to another Israeli politician named Yair Lapid, who heads the centrist party Yesh Atid. Just a few days after being given this task, Israel launched a new assault on Gaza on May 10th, with massive bombings of public and health infrastructure, slaughtering hundreds of Palestinians and leaving thousands more wounded. Keep in mind that Netanyahu has been troubled by a massive corruption scandal during the last years, a case that remains open and still not reached a conclusion. And it's widely speculated, and perhaps not unreasonably so, that throughout his tenure, Netanyahu has resorted to many tactics, exploiting various crises, such as attacking Gaza, in order to distract from his internal problems and rivalries. Now, his political rivals stopped just short of publicly accusing him of attacking Gaza in May as a ruse to distract from his corruption scandal and troubles of forming a coalition government. And indeed, for a moment, this proved to be fruitful, with multiple outlets reporting that any hopes of a coalition government had been eviscerated. After all, nothing unites Zionists more than the oppression and occupation of Palestinians. But nevertheless, despite his attempts to crush the hopes of his rivals in wrestling the premiership from him, after the ceasefire between Hamas and the Israelis, brokered by Egypt on May 21st, talks between Netanyahu's rivals of forming a coalition government to get rid of him resumed in the wake of the bloodbath that had left so many killed and injured in Palestine. On May 30th, 2021, Naftali Bennett announced that he would be joining with Yair Lapid in the aim of forming a so-called unity government. This would include a coalition of eight different parties from all across the political spectrum. On June 2nd, minutes before the deadline, a coalition government was forged, which would see the role of Prime Minister shared, with Bennett taking the reins for 2 years, and then Lapid. On June 13th, 2021, Naftali Bennett was sworn in as Prime Minister, and during his speech in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, several Netanyahu loyalists attempted to interrupt him, accusing him of treachery as they were being removed from the chamber. Netanyahu himself gave a fiery speech accusing his rivals of election fraud, and much like former US President Trump, refused to accept the results, calling it the greatest election fraud in history, perhaps even in the history of democracy. When entering the Knesset, he sat in the Prime Minister's chair before being told to relocate to a different seat. And in the final moments of his ouster, Netanyahu implied that the new government was doing the bidding of Tehran, of Hamas and Hezbollah, by gifting them with his removal from power. And then he gave a final warning just before he left, saying, quote, "We'll be back." Indeed, he intends to remain the leader of his Likud party and to lead the opposition, with many speculating that Netanyahu will be back and that he'll try to run again and wrestle control of the premiership back into his grasp. Now, what makes the coalition put together interesting is not just the fact that it's comprised of eight parties on seemingly opposing ends of the political spectrum, but also includes for the first time some Israeli Arab politicians as part of the United Arab List. Now, eight parties, all united by their common hatred for Netanyahu, managed to get rid of him. But what of his replacement? What of Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli Prime Minister, and the head of the far-right party, New Right, which is also under the umbrella of the Yamina movement, an ultra-nationalist movement? Naftali Bennett originally started outside of politics. He made his fortunes as a tech millionaire, having lived for a while in the United States His parents are originally American Jews who moved from the United States to occupied Palestine. Like most Israeli settlers, either they themselves, their parents, or their grandparents all come from outside of Palestine. They are not indigenous to Palestine. Just ask any Palestinian where their grandparents were born, and I can assure you, most of them will not tell you the USA or Germany or Ukraine or wherever else. Now, before politics, Bennett was also part of the Israeli occupation forces and took part in numerous attacks on Lebanon, including the Qana massacre in 1996, when the Israelis shelled a United Nations compound, killing 106 Lebanese civilians. Originally, Bennett entered politics under a right-wing party and then went on to join Yamina, which identifies as ultra-nationalist. Once again, it's a bit difficult to understand what they mean here, since every political party there by default validates the Israeli occupation and upholds its existence, which by its very nature oppresses Palestinians in favor of a Jewish nation state. Now, Bennett has always publicly opposed a Palestinian state and always supported the expansion of illegal settlements. At one point, he was the head of the Yesa Council, a large settler organization. Needless to say, these settlers live in Palestine illegally. There are multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions stating very clearly that these settlements are unlawful and stand in violation of international law. When it comes to his animosity and hatred towards Palestinians, there's no shortage of comments there. Perhaps to further illustrate how much of a wonderful person Bennett is, let's look at a few of his quotes, shall we? Bennett once said in 2018 that he would, quote, not give another centimeter to the Arabs. In 2013, during an interview with The Guardian, he said, there is not going to be a Palestinian state within the tiny land of Israel. He previously also expressed his disdain for international law, claiming somehow that Israel's numerous illegal annexations, declared null and void by the United Nations, are not illegal, according to him. In 2012, he was quoted in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz as saying, quote, I will do everything in my power forever to fight against a Palestinian state. He's also called Palestinian children terrorists and said, quote, I've killed lots of Arabs in my life, and there's no problem with that. And of course, this is the man that Western leaders like U.S. President Joe Biden and others immediately call and congratulate and grovel to. You see, racism and terrorism are fine with them as long as it's happening to Arabs and Muslims. Equally, Bennett's cabinet members have no shortage of colorful comments either. Yair Lapid, who will take over after 2 years as the alternate prime minister, said that he is, quote, enthusiastically in favor of annexing the Syrian Golan Heights. My principle says maximum Jews on maximum land with maximum security with minimum Palestinians. The new finance minister, Lieberman, said once in 2006 that, quote, any Arab members of the Knesset who meet with representatives of the PA's Hamas-led government should be executed. And previously, when he was transport minister, on Palestinian prisoners, he said that, quote, it would be better to drown these prisoners in the Dead Sea if possible, since that's the lowest point in the world. Benny Gantz, who was supposed to share the premiership with Netanyahu under a coalition agreement, has now been reappointed defense minister and new deputy prime minister. Just one day after assuming the role of prime minister, Bennett proceeded to bomb Gaza on the night of June 15th to June 16th, and then again a second time during the same week on June 17th. In the Israeli and Western corporate media, the story was reported as the Israelis launching airstrikes in response to incendiary balloons launched by Hamas, which of course sounds very proportionate and civilized. Naturally, the media left out the part that this was a response to the flag march in Al-Quds, in the holy city of Jerusalem. One of the first actions taken by Bennett's administration was to approve a right-wing march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was captured in the 1967 war and consequently annexed. It has been under illegal Israeli occupation ever since. These are the same mobs that have been carrying out pogroms for the last few months that just marched through Jerusalem, looting and damaging Palestinian-owned businesses. They have been filmed laughing and joking at the death of Palestinians, calling for a second Nakba and for the ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinian population. All of this, of course, with the protection of Israeli police who stand there and coddle them and do nothing. And not only that, but they participate with them in oppressing the Palestinians. One woman who held a Palestinian flag was filmed being beaten to the ground by Israeli police. Under Bennett, Palestinians were also offered 1 million vaccines by the Israelis, with one caveat: they're expired. And so not only does the medical apartheid continue, but all of the apartheid continues, all of the cruelty, the entire cruelty of the occupation in all its dimensions continues. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Dr. Bassem Naim. He is the former Palestinian health minister and now the head of the International Relations Office of Hamas in Gaza. Thank you for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you on, Doctor.
Please, an honor to be with you today.
So, Doctor, I wanted to ask you, first of all, this new prime minister of the Israeli occupation, Naftali Bennett, he's made remarks in the past that he is proud to have killed Arabs. He is completely against any Palestinian state. I wanted to ask you, this change of leadership, does it mean anything for Palestinians? What does it actually represent on the ground in reality?
Look, for us Palestinians here, it doesn't make any difference between these different Israeli governments, right or left, and if it is a negative change. Look, when it comes to the Palestinian issue, we believe, and this is the practical thing we see on the ground, there is no differences between right and left. All what they are discussing is only internal issues, internal Israeli issues. But when it comes to the Palestinian conflict, when it comes to the borders, the settlements, to Jerusalem, to refugees, right to return, the right to attack Palestinians, to suffocate them, since 1948, we have a steady, constant policy from all governments. And if there is a change in when it comes to this new government, maybe it is a negative one. I mean, more aggression, more violence against the Palestinian existence here on the land. But if there is a question, we have the right to raise it as Palestinians there today, that why the international community, in particular the West, Europe, and America, usually exercising a lot of pressures on Palestinians to go on the path of what so-called peace and stability and prosperity, and they are asking us to review our curricula in the schools, they are asking us to review our media, and so on. But when it comes to what so-called the prime minister, who is proud of killing Palestinians or Arabs in general, and he is ready to repeat it again and again, when we have a minister of interior, the so-called Ayla Shaqid, when she is publicly stated that she is calling for killing all Palestinian mothers because they are going to give birth for a new terrorist, I hope that the international community can leave the position of not only double standard, double or treble standards, to hear clear, not only clear statements, but also actions towards the such terrorist government.
How does it make you feel to see Arabs, Palestinians in this coalition government? What kind of message does that send? How does that make you feel?
The Palestinians generally are divided here in two parties. One party see that this is their right to decide how to deal with the status quo without recognizing the occupation as a state, and the other part, which is forbidding totally any engagement, especially at the official level with the Israeli occupation. We here in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, I mean the occupied territories in 1967, we leave this for them to decide how to deal with this with their situation inside the occupied territories in 1948, but on the bottom line, the baseline is not to recognize this occupation or to legitimize it.
So, you know, Doctor, I wanted to ask of you. We saw these Israeli marches through Al-Quds, through Jerusalem, where these mobs are chanting "Death to Arabs." You know, they're laughing and joking. They're calling for a second Nakba, for more ethnic cleansing. And at the same time, as you saw, unfortunately, they started bombing Gaza again. They broke the ceasefire on May 21st. You know, they attacked public health infrastructure. Many clinics and hospitals were damaged. Al Shifa Hospital, which I'm sure you know very well, they bombed the road leading there. And I mean, it's not the first time, is it? But you know, what do you have to say about this massacring of Palestinians that is still ongoing? The damage to infrastructure, the medical apartheid, in the broader context of the occupation of Palestine.
Look, when we hear this group of extremists chanting openly and publicly death to Arabs and death to Muslims, or calling for destroying Al-Aqsa Mosque, or so on, it, and protected by the Israeli police and covered by all Israeli media, calling or considering them as heroes, this is reflecting that this is the official policy of the state of Israel. This is not a group of gangs at the periphery of the mainstream of the state. It is in the heart of this group of young people are representing Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked and other official figures in the state of Israel. When it comes to the massacring of Palestinians, again, this is the adopted policy since 1948. Look, if you go through the diary, in each day you will find the memory or the anniversary, sorry, of one or two or three, or sometimes in one day, five or six massacres committed by the Israel, by the Zionist entity or their groups since 1948 until today, either here in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, in Tunis, and everywhere. Therefore, again and again, this is the adopted official policy of this Zionist entity, how to eliminate the Palestinian existence on this land and around it. When it comes to attacking health facilities or killing children, usually they are using some allegations that they are targeting security offices or offices affiliated to the resistance. First of all, they were not able to show one proof of their allegations until today. Second, we know if they want to target someone specifically, they can do it. You know that they have the most sophisticated weapons, the most precise weapons supported by the Americans. Why to destroy a house or a building with 13 or 14 floor because of the allegations they have one or two offices in this high buildings working for the resistance.
And doctor, just as a final question, you've been very gracious with your time. I just want to ask you, what can people who are listening, the viewers, what can they do to help the Palestinian cause? And you know, very often we never get to hear directly from Palestinians in the English-speaking world. Everything about Hamas is filtered through the Zionist narrative, through the Western narrative. So I want to give you the floor, and I want to ask you, what would you like to say directly to the viewers, to the audience?
Thank you very much. This is a very important question. And I will start from the point you have raised, because this is the most important point. The Israeli or the Zionist entity is depending on two pillars. The first one, their own capacity or capabilities here, security and air forces and army, and the other one, the international support, because they are presenting themselves as representative of the Western values, of the Western cultures, as a civilized state, as a state which is defending human rights and equity, and so on. This image, I think anyone will be very helpful for the Palestinians if they convey the reality on the ground here, that this is a fascist colonial project violating all kinds of human rights, all kinds of good values, or the values of more or most civilized people, equity and justice and freedom of expression, freedom of journalism. We have seen it live in real time, how they are killing children, how they are attacking women, how they are squashing men and women on crossings in the West Bank or in Jerusalem. Therefore, to help Palestinians to convey their message or to convey the Palestinian narrative to pass through this filter is a very great help for us. The second thing is, we Palestinians, we are not war, what we call it in English, we are not war makers or war lovers. We are really looking to live in peace. We are really looking to live that our children have the chance of a better life, a dignified life, to live like any children around the world. And we have given all the chances to the Zionist entity and to the international community to solve this political conflict in a peaceful way or a political way, avoiding further bloodshed and killing of people, of children and women. But they have always denied our basic rights of a statehood, of dignity, of freedom. Therefore, we have resorted to armed resistance, which is guaranteed right in the international law, by the way. It is our full right to resist the occupation. We are the oppressed people, and the Israelis are the oppressor, and we have the right to resist it. But we have resorted to this track or to this tool because we have seen after 7 decades that no one is really caring about our life, about our future.
Let us not forget that during his tenure, Netanyahu oversaw the assassinations of several Iranian nuclear scientists. He openly and vehemently rejected the Iran nuclear deal in any diplomatic endeavors. He approved several acts of sabotage and nuclear terrorism against Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and then had the nerve to go to the United Nations General Assembly and accuse Iran of developing a nuclear weapon, when Israel is the only party who has nuclear weapons. Netanyahu oversaw the brutal assaults on Gaza in 2014 and again in 2021, with thousands of Palestinians being ruthlessly murdered and wounded. In 2016, he secured the largest package of military aid from the United States in history, totaling $38 billion over a period of 10 years to subsidize these atrocities. He launched hundreds of airstrikes on Syria, if not thousands, taking advantage of the chaotic situation in Syria to attack her while she was weak. Under his rule, the Israelis openly worked to assist and give aid to Al-Qaeda fighters inside Syria just for the sake of helping to topple the Syrian government. Netanyahu tried to move forward with his annexation plan on July 1st, 2020, but ultimately didn't. His plans to annex a further 30% of the West Bank, they didn't come to fruition, but he still tried, and he still got something else in return: normalization of ties with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates in the form of the Abraham Accords, orchestrated by a grinning Trump, who also moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to occupy Jerusalem and recognized the illegally occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli. So how different is Bennett if he supports all these and more? On the eve of Bennett taking power, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry issued a statement clearly saying that this is not real change, because there is no change in the attitude towards Palestinians. That, quote, "As for the new government's policies, we estimate we will see no difference or perhaps even worse ones." Similar statements were echoed by Hamas and Palestinians alike everywhere. And indeed, let us be under no illusions. Whether Netanyahu had stayed or is replaced by Bennett makes little difference. Perhaps Bennett is more direct in his approach and his rhetoric and speaks with more animosity. But his actions are just as bad as Netanyahu's, if not perhaps slightly worse. Just like his predecessor, he is in favor of annexation. He supports expanding the illegal settlements. He is in favor of brutal military assaults bombing Gaza, allowing Zionists to march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem unchecked, chanting death to Arabs. Bennett is in favor of ethnic cleansing, of genocide, of oppressing Palestinians, and making sure they never attain statehood, nor be given their basic human rights. Bennett, just like Netanyahu, is the leader of an occupation. It's that simple. And unfortunately, this means that nothing changes on the ground. This means that Palestinians continue to live under a racist, apartheid entity, under colonialism that is supported and subsidized by the West. Indeed, nothing has changed, save for a few faces and a few names. The cruelty of oppression, of occupation, of colonialism and apartheid continues in all its dimensions. This has not changed and not stopped. And therefore, neither should the resistance to colonialism and imperialism. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.